Kelly, the wife of legendary dancer, director, and choreographer Gene Kelly, and I'm talking to Rabbi Saul Solomon today on Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Oh, my friends, ladies, and gentlemen here in the neighborhood, this is Rabbi Saul Solomon, the founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And I am dancing on air, I'm dancing on walls, I'm dancing around trees, because we're going to be talking to someone who may be the biggest living expert on one of the greatest all-time movie performers and dancers ever. His name was Gene Kelly. Of course, you know him from A Gentleman in Paris and Anchors Away and Singing in the Rain. He was voted the 42nd greatest movie star of all time by Entertainment Weekly. I'm 4,642, but I'm hoping with my next independent movie I might rise a notch. But the important thing is that we're talking with his widow, Patricia Ward Kelly. They were married for almost 10 years at the very end of his life. And so she has all these stories about her life and her time with him. She's writing a biography about him. And you can see her live in the flesh at the Peter J. Sharp Theater. This is on July 9th at Symphony Space, an evening with Patricia Ward Kelly. But we have a morning here with Patricia Ward Kelly in the neighborhood. Welcome, Patty. How you doing?
Oh, I'm happy to be here talking with you. This is a real delight. What a privilege.
Oh, it's a privilege and a delight for me. First of all, if you had a Hebrew name, what would it be?
Well, I'm the Shabbos Goy in my neighborhood, and interestingly, Gene was the Shabbos Goy in his neighborhood, so I think we have a deep connection here.
Now, let us explain to our listeners, believe it or not all of whom are Jewish, that the Shabbos Goy is someone who is a shiksa or a shegitz, whom the Jewish community gets to turn on lights and do things that the Jews aren't allowed to do on the Sabbath. This is correct, right?
This is correct, and Gene taught dance at the Beth Shalom Shul in Squirrel Hill in Pittsburgh, where he grew up, and he was granted that responsibility to turn the lights on and everything for the shul. So, and he spoke Yiddish, which was...
Now, wait, but how on earth does Gene Kelly start speaking Yiddish?
Well, Gene was really, he had a great facility with language, and one of the nice things about this one-woman show that I've been doing is people walk out of the theater, and one of the first things they say is, I never knew that about him, because they don't realize he spoke French fluently, he spoke street Italian, he spoke Yiddish. He learned the Yiddish to teach the kids, and he would bring the boys in, coerce them to take dancing lessons by promising to teach them basketball, but... He really was, interestingly, we bonded over words. That was how we first met, and our mutual love of language and of word origins, of etymology. And so talking to him was this incredible blend. I always said it was like talking to this very erudite gentleman, but also a Pittsburgh street kid, and he would blend Latin phrases and French phrases and poetry and just this phenomenal mix, and not in a self-conscious way. It's just how he was and just who he was.
Now, let me ask you, it could be Yiddish or French, right? What was Gene Kelly's favorite word? Do you have one?
Well, he used to talk about the phrase cellar door. He thought was so beautiful. He thought the sound of the word cellar door.
Cellar door. Interesting.
We would drive by a mailbox when we would go to head west on Sunset. There was a mailbox that we would pass all the time, and it had the name on it was Noor Mahal. And Gene would sit in the car and just say Noor Mahal. The beauty of the sound of the word. So.
Sounds a little abnormal to me. And my favorite word is help. Because I end up having to use it every other day on the toilet or anywhere I am. But still, talking with Patricia Ward Kelly here, let me ask you, 1985 was the year you met Gene Kelly at the Smithsonian. What were you doing there? What was he doing there? And how did you get together, as it were?
Well, I do go into that in great detail in the show, but I'll give you a little bit of a teaser.
Just a teaser.
I was
yeah.
writing, had been brought on as a writer on a documentary film, a documentary television show about the Smithsonian, and the host narrator was Gene Kelly, and so I worked with him. They had fired the original writers and brought me on as a writer, and so there really was no script developed, so I sat in a room with Gene and crafted this piece. But the grand irony that I will reveal is that I did not know who Gene Kelly was. I was this very, very nerdy Herman Melville scholar, and didn't know. I didn't go to the movies, and I didn't watch them on television, and we didn't have...
No, wait, how old were you?
Well, again, I'm giving quite a bit away here, but I was 26.
And he was 77 at that point, or?
73.
Okay, well, wow, okay.
But I never noticed he was so, so bright and so young at heart and so terribly handsome and charming. I mean, he was breathtaking. And as I say, I really, our mutual love was of word origins. It was of etymology and poetry, and we sat in the room together and played word games and quoted poetry back and forth, and I became absolutely enchanted with him.
Well, how long did it take to go from colleagues to friendship to a romance?
He brought me out to California after we worked together on the Smithsonian project, then he brought me out to California to write his memoir. He called and asked me if I could come out. I didn't know that's what it was for originally. He just said that there were some projects, and so I came out.
He wanted to show you his etchings, I think.
I was only supposed to come for about 2 weeks, and we got married 5 years into that project. So I immediately, I think once I spent time with him, I immediately was, as I say, I really fell in love with his who he was, which was interesting because I hadn't seen the guy up on the screen. So I didn't, like most people, they love him. They sure. fall over when they see him. But I had never seen that. So I didn't know the actor. I just knew this man who was sitting across from me at the table.
So what was the first Gene Kelly movie that you saw once you already knew when you were with him, as it were?
Well, that's a good question. I honestly can't remember exactly which one. What I did is I went to the video store and got all of the Gene Kelly movies they had and then just ran them sequentially nonstop, and pretty stunned that I had missed this major part of the 20th century, and obviously just blown away by what I saw on the screen. And it was so interesting because I always say, you know, what turnip truck did I fall off of that I didn't know who Gene Kelly was, but...
Had you heard of Fred Astaire? Had you heard of Ingrid Bergman? Were you completely out of the loop?
I think I would say I did know who Gregory Peck was because he was supposed to be the original narrator at the Smithsonian, and I had seen To Kill a Mockingbird, and so I wasn't completely out of it, but I was really... I was at the generation... I grew up protesting the Vietnam War, more into the politics and out on the streets and things. So I wasn't, I mean, the posters I had on my wall were Kent State and
wow.
various political posters and not movie. I wasn't swooning over the heartthrobs in Hollywood. So, but I think that was really the way to get to know Gene, because I got to know the man before I knew the screen legend.
And also he was, I think you probably bonded on that too, because he was fairly left-wing Democrat political too, right?
Absolutely. He was very left-wing. He'd worked for the Kennedys, and both John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy, and he'd worked with Roosevelt and Truman, and it just was obviously a very, very thoughtful guy, and he was an economics major in college, which a lot of people don't know, but he graduated from the University of Pittsburgh with an economics degree. But it was after the Depression, the big stock market crash, and he went in and he actually read the economic treatises and things and studied Mein Kampf and various...
He studied Mein Kampf, my God.
Yeah, and Maynard Keynes, and trying to absorb and understand what had happened in this country. And so it was something that always, it never really left him. I think growing up as a child of the Depression, it was deeply influenced the work they created, the particularly American style of dance. And it, I think it, he never took it for granted, the fame or what came with fame, because he knew it could crash very, very suddenly. And he always had a great humility about it, I felt.
Well, let me ask you a question, though. You saw him as this incredible, erudite, handsome, etc. person. You didn't see an age difference there. But when you did marry him 5 years into the relationship, did you have some convincing to do of your family and your friends?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear. Did I have some what?
Did you have some convincing to do?
No, not at all. Interestingly, particularly my parents, I've never been particularly conventional in anything that I've done, so I don't think it really surprised them, and they knew the depth of the relationship and knew how unique it was, but also how very significant it was. So it was nothing. Gene called my father. Gene was born in 1912, and my father was born in 1925, and he called to tell him we were getting married. But I don't think it surprised them at all. They came out and spent time with us, and I think they really grasped the why it was such a special relationship.
And during marriage, how long did you have before he had the stroke?
We were together a little over 10 years, and we were married for 6 of those. But I was living there with him, and then he had the stroke. Was the last 19 covered the last 19 months of his life? So it was, he had a stroke in 1994 and then died in 1996. And even with the stroke, yeah, his mind was absolutely intact. He just lost the use of his body, which was profound. But what was interesting is that my primary job was as a journalist, as a biographer with him, and the wife came second, and so I had a responsibility to record everything that he said during the day. And so I don't think there are many spouses who have taken that upon themselves to write down everything their spouse says. And
thank God, no marriage would last. The things I've said to my dear wife, Miriam Libby, oh my God.
Well, I'm so grateful for that, because as I craft the memoir, I have it all down in some format. So in this over near daily recordings over 10 years of... I have some things that were done with a tape recorder, some things he would just start spewing some comments and I would jot them down on a yellow legal pad, and then often one of the things that he loved most was to go to a piano bar at night and listen to the music, and it would just evoke the songs of his youth, September Song and Autumn Leaves and Stardust and things, and as he would hear the music, it would just, some these memories would come back to him, and so I was very rapidly jotting everything down on cocktail napkins and sugar packs and anything I could find to try to get these very intimate recollections. And so I have this extraordinary story, and that is what formed the spine of the show that people will see at Symphony Space and that they've been seeing. I launched it for his centenary 2 years ago, and it's been running across the country, and I'm glad to bring it back to New York. It was at Lincoln Center 2 years ago, and it's a really personal look at this man, and basically I call it Gene on Gene, or Gene Kelly Unplugged, because it's a story no one has, and I allow people to hear how Gene described his work and himself. And
well, the question that might be asked is that you guys were already working on his autobiography/biography when he was alive. He died in 1996. How much longer before we have a book?
Well, I think people always ask that. They always say, why is it taking you so long to write this book? And I think it's not like I'm writing about Ernest Hemingway or someone that I wasn't deeply in love with and deeply involved with. There's an element of grief as I had to begin to go through the materials again after he died. Some of these things you find, you pull out of a box, and there, it's wonderful to have these records and these quotes from him, but they also can pack a pretty powerful punch. So you've got this mixture of joy of finding something, but it can also bring on a kind of a deluge as well. And then I think it's taken quite a bit of time for me to. I was brought on as a ghostwriter to write the story in Gene's voice, and after he died, I decided that I would shift it to my own voice and use his quotes. I thought it was a little disingenuous to pretend to be him, and better because I could say what he said and very directly. And I think it was hard for him to talk about himself and what he contributed, and hard for him to talk about his genius and his brightness, his humor, his wit, and things like that. So that was a shift. And then I think I would have to say that going out on the road and doing this show has also helped to shape the writing, because I greet people as they come in the theater, and I stay after to speak with people after the show. And what I hear from people is just extraordinary, and the personal stories they share, and also listening to the audience and how they respond to the comments throughout. I adjust the show. It's extemporaneous, so I can move where the audience moves and change the show slightly each time. And it has helped to guide what I've been putting on paper. So I think that it's definitely time to finish the book, and yeah. I have to tell you, before we started this, I was actively working on it this morning, so I'm pretty excited about that. And
I mean, are you on page 1247? Because if you jog it down, everything.
1247.
Well, I'm just saying, it's like at a certain point, there's also an editor required. You know, every little scrap of paper may have had certain meaning for you, but somebody's got to go in there and say, okay, let's tell the story of his life and not go down too many highways and byways and get lost in it either.
That, I would say, is much of what has taken the time, because I do have such an extraordinary volume of material that I'm editing and selecting and choosing what is it that really. Because there are many, many stories, as you say, many to tell, and I have details from him about how he did each of his films and why he chose this camera angle. And
well, tell us a little. Let's give us an example, if you would. I'm going to pick a movie and something where something came to him and it changed the nature of the way we see dance on film. What would be an example?
Let's take Singin' in the Rain, which would be your most iconic thing. If you think about dance prior to Gene Kelly, often the dance numbers, you could essentially cut them out of the movie. They were often performed on a stage. They didn't further the plot. It's just that everybody in the show is a dancer or an actor or something, and they decide to put on a show, and they go onto a stage, or they go onto a polished ballroom floor and dance. But it doesn't. If you cut it out of the movie, it doesn't matter. It just and often they were cut out, but it doesn't extend the storyline. And Gene's whole position was that the dance had to further the plot, and that you use the dance in that way. And he always said that it was very different when you choreograph for the stage. It's very different than how you choreograph for the camera, because the camera, as he called it, was this one-eyed monster. You lose a third dimension, and so he was always trying to figure out, how do you capture this three-dimensional art form and lose a dimension and make the figures appear round and not flat? He quite literally took dancing into the streets. What you see in the Singin' in the Rain number is that the camera becomes the person watching. So instead of sitting in a seat and watching a proscenium stage where you have peripheral vision, the camera becomes the viewer, and he's constantly moving toward that camera. If you watch him in Sing in the Rain or in It's Always Fair Weather when he's roller skating, he gets a kinetic energy and a kinetic sense of movement that adds to this three-dimensional quality. And so as often as he could, he's taking the dance off of a set stage, moving it into the life. And so in Sing in the Rain, here he's in love, he's kissed the girl, said goodnight to her, waved off the cab. And how does he express this tremendous joy that he's in love? Well, he does what every kid wants to do and people do, is that they splash in puddles and dance and sing in the rain. And
which, by the way, apparently he was doing when he had a 103-degree fever.
And that is one of the true things about, there's a lot of mythology about Sing in the Rain. For example, there's no milk in the water. That's a big myth, and actually does a great disservice to the extraordinary cameramen and lighting technicians, because it was very hard to backlight rain. If you ever go to the ballpark and it starts to rain and you look down at the field, you don't see the raindrops, but when you tilt your head back and you look at the lights, stadium lights, you see the rain pouring down. They had a very difficult time, because if you remember that number, Gene's dancing along in front of the glass-plated windows of the stores. So instead, they couldn't put lights behind the rain to backlight it, to make it show up, because you'd see the lights reflected in the glass. It was very tricky to do. And then they also had to light Gene from the front. And so I have a lot of the photographs showing where the lights were positioned and everything. But that was an unusual thing. He would choreograph everything in his head at night, the night before, and including the puddles. So he would go in the next day, and then they had to carve the puddles out of the street to, and they ended up putting sawdust in them to help with the splashing. And so those were all choreographed. And
it was him, not so much Stanley Donen, or Donen would, how would they collaborate?
Gene always said Stanley Donen was Gene's assistant and originally, and was behind the camera, because when Gene is directing, choreographing, and performing, he's wearing so many hats. And it was what he needed, what was very essential, was to have someone behind the camera who had a sense of musicality, a sense of musical beats, because often the things that Gene created and choreographed, the way that he could accomplish them was by moving the camera to musical beats, and then he could time the sequences of his dance numbers. For example, the famous alter ego number in Cover Girl. And so, Gene, I have the production notes are all here at USC, and it's a detailed record. It'll say, for example, from 353 to 354, Gene Kelly retied left shoe. And I'm not kidding about the detail of these production records. And so it will say Gene Kelly is up on the camera with Stanley Donen and setting the camera shot. And then it has Gene Kelly go down in front of the camera to set things. He pops back behind the camera, sets the lights and everything. And I was on the road with the great Rita Moreno for the 60th anniversary of Singing in the Rain 2 years ago. And she has a small but terrific part, obviously, in Singing in the Rain. And she said that the days that she was not on camera, she would go watch all of the filming. And she said it was unbelievable to watch. She said Gene was just constantly in motion, that behind the camera, in front of the camera, behind the camera, in front, checking on everything. And so Stanley and Gene's other assistants, Carol Haney and Jeannie Coyne, who became his second wife, were instrumental in making sure that Gene hit every mark, that the camera moved appropriately, that Gene's face was appropriate, that his head was tilted correctly, and so it was a collaboration. It was absolutely required to have these parties working together. But as far as actually choreographing what you see of Gene, that was Gene. What you see is Gene's work.
Now, We're talking, by the way, with the wonderful Patricia Ward Kelly, whom we can all see, if you're in New York, at Symphony Space, the Peter J. Sharp Theater, on Wednesday night, July 9th, doing Gene Kelly, The Legacy, an evening with Patricia Ward Kelly, talking about her late husband. Did he ever run into any kind of flack for being so... Well, let me put it this way. A lot of dance, especially if you're talking about Broadway, there's a gay component to it. A lot of the chorus people, there's a lot of gayness to dance in that context. He was very much about dance being virile and, you know, macho and mannish, and was against effeminacy in dance. Did he take any flack for that?
Well, it was... He did a television special called Dancing a Man's Game for Omnibus in 1958. We just released it on DVD, and it's available. A lot of people have been asking for it. And one of the biggest challenges for him, even when he was a little boy going off to dancing school, his mother forced him to go to school. He hated it. And he would come home, and the little boys in the neighborhood would be waiting on the corner and would beat him up because he, and call him a sissy because he'd gone off to dancing school. And he thought it was for sissies. He thought he didn't want any part of it. And but then he realized that girls actually liked a guy who could dance, so he pursued it more. But it was a constant thing that... So he created this television special called Dancing a Man's Game to show that, in fact, the movement of dance is essentially the same as all of the major sports. And so he brought on the great sports figures of the day, Mickey Mantle, Vic Satius, Johnny Unitas, Bob Cousy, and it's a wonderful piece, Sugar Ray Robinson. And he takes each of the sports figures, and he has them do what they do, and then he takes their movement and incorporates it into a dance number, just showing that the baseball, and that really gets to the origins of Gene's particular style of dance. It came through sports, because he wanted to create something that was very distinct from the European tradition of ballroom dancing on polished floors, the kind of what Fred Astaire, the tradition that Astaire had continued so beautifully. Gene, growing out of this lower middle class Irish Catholic upbringing in Pittsburgh and watching his father be destroyed in the Depression, Gene said, I don't want to dance like rich people on polished floors. I want to dance like the American man, the common man. But he couldn't find any model for that. He couldn't, how does an American man move? And what he did was he looked at sports, and particularly hockey. He had grown up, wanted to be a hockey player, but there was no professional team in Pittsburgh. And
There still isn't. No, just kidding. Yes.
Yeah, but if you look at the style of dance, not only does he take it out into the streets, but it is a very broad dance form. It's broad, open strokes, very low to the ground, and that's from the origins of hockey. And he used to talk about, when I first met him, one of the things we did, we watched the playoffs for the World Series on TV, and he talked about the connections between classical ballet and baseball, and always said that there's nothing more beautiful than, more balletic than a double play and a forward pass in football. And these, I found it the other day as I was going through things, a file that he kept. He would clip photos out of the sports pages in the LA Times and New York Times and of these beautiful men playing basketball and leaping into the air, and you could see that Gene's seen that it's a perfect ballet configuration. Or so it was something that he constantly battled, in that people questioning his sexuality so he tried to kind of set that record straight. And I think that because he felt that you could be graceful and masculine at the same time. You didn't have to have one or the other. And his great heroes growing up were Douglas Fairbanks Sr. and Lon Chaney Sr. And it was watching their movements to see these extraordinarily athletic, graceful men. It obviously infused him with this notion that you could be both. And so it's funny, today you watch something like Dancing with the Stars, the football players win, and they'll always say, they'll have Emmitt Smith winning or something, and they'll say that he made it okay for guys to dance or something, and I kind of always have to smile a bit, because I think there was somebody else a little bit before that who was setting that tradition.
Well, Gene Kelly, as we said, lived until the mid-1990s, which meant that he was around to see hip-hop and street dance and all of that. Did you have any thoughts on all of that, fly girls and fly boys and that kind of dance?
Well, he loved it. I mean, if you look at the opening of That's Dancing from 1985, he opens it. He's on the street with the street dancers, hip-hop and the body poppers and things, and he says, if I were that age, that's what I'd be doing. And so he had great regard for all forms of movement and new forms of movement. But I say new because he also knew that all of those things came from something before. So he knew the traditions of how Jitterbug and Lindy and all these things would have influenced more contemporary dance things that you're seeing, and then how Irish clog dancing was the generation, began blending with jazz music with the American South, and then jazz music to create tap dance. And so he was just this font of knowledge, and I think that's one thing that distinguished him, is that there are many great dancers, but I think there are fewer people who completely understand the history of their art form and the diversity of it, the breadth of it. And he studied every form of dance and learned it, because he felt like you needed to know everything. You needed to know every form, because you had to use a particular form of dance to tell the story. So, for example, there's no tap dancing in The Pirate because it doesn't fit with the story of the Caribbean in that century. And I think something that really distinguishes Gene is that he was a classically trained ballet dancer, a Spanish dancer, an acrobat, a gymnast, a tightrope walker.
Good Lord. Wow. And by the way, is it true, I think the Internet Movie Database lists the fact that he was a dance consultant for the 1993 Madonna tour?
He was on the Girly Show, and Madonna actually fired him from that job. So
whoa, why?
Well, you'd have to ask her that. But I think it was an interesting period, and I was I had to kind of give him that news, and I remember he was so excited about it. He loved working with new people and young artists and creative projects. And I think one of the things is that, like Gene, like David Lean, like Richard Brooks, like Fred Zinnemann, Jonathan Winters, there's a kind of ageism that comes into play, and these are these extraordinary geniuses in their fields, and Gene was always so far ahead of his time. I think that's one of the reasons we're still watching his movies 60, 70 years later, is that he was breaking new ground constantly. I mean, he was putting live action and animation together with Jerry the Mouse and dancing with himself in the Alter Ego number, and these kind of extraordinary things that had not been done before. And so I think a lot of the younger artists, pop artists, and their managers figured that Gene Kelly was maybe old-fashioned, old-school, couldn't really contribute, so...
Well, it was kind of sad a couple of months ago on the Dave's Gone By radio program, we had a biographer of Busby Berkeley on the show.
Oh, right.
Wrote a book about him and said that he had been hired for the Broadway show No No Nanette, which was kind of a later production. I think it was the 70s or 80s or something like that. And they hired him as a dance consultant and choreographer, and he was really just there for the name, and they completely abused him and barely used him, and he was let go shortly thereafter. So that's what happens.
I think that happens, and I think that's a... I have the notes that Gene... He was, as I say, so excited. He would sit in the chair, and I have his notes on yellow legal pads as he was going 100 miles an hour. His mind always was moving and thinking of these fantastic things to do with Madonna and the Girly Show. And I don't know why. Maybe she didn't want another star like that, and that creative. I can't say. I don't know. I don't know why she made the decision. But it is interesting that the name still got used for it.
Can I ask Patricia Ward Kelly, besides Singing in the Rain, what might be or might have been Gene Kelly's favorite moment on film, like the thing he was most proud of, or something that might surprise us that we wouldn't even think of?
Well, and you'll see those in the show, because I tried to use some of the things that are less obvious, because people always turn to Singing in the Rain, and I've incorporated really wonderful film clips, and you'll see those on a very big screen, that things that some people may never have seen, some people may have seen rarely, some people will see them in a different light when they hear Gene's comments about them. He was not someone who liked to watch his movies. A lot of people love watching their movies. Gene would cringe because he would see things that he wished he could have done better or differently. But I made him watch everything because for our work together. And so I remember I would put the tape recorder next to us as we watched. And he was very proud of the ballet, American in Paris. I think he felt that was a piece that he had done well. Of course, he saw some things in it that he wished had been better, but I think overall he was very proud of that, and very proud of a number in Summer Stock where he dances with Judy Garland called You Wonderful You, and it's a charming piece, a very tender piece, and he said to me that may be the classiest number I ever did, and I go into a little more detail about that in the show, and you'll see that particular number.
You are the keeper of the Gene Kelly flame. You're, I guess, the executor tricks of the stuff, the archives. I mean, he still has, I think, 3 living kids. He lost one of his grandchildren a couple of years ago. But
yes, sadly.
Everybody gets along. Everybody's cool. They're okay with you being, like, the go-to person for all the stuff that has to get done.
Gene did name me as the trustee of his name, voice, and likeness, and they're all beneficiaries of that. So that's... He knew because I had worked with him on a lot of that decision-making during his lifetime, and so I think he knew that was a natural role, and the thing that I inherited from him were the things that survived his fire from the archives, so the letters and the photographs. And I was trained as an archivist, and so I think, again, he knew that would be a good way to handle things because I knew how to... I've actually put the things in archival sleeves, and I knew how to create the database and catalog things. And I was the one who... talked to him about each of the... I sat with him and went through a lot of the documents and recorded his comments. If I read a letter or he saw a letter from someone, then he would comment about it, and I have attached those comments to the items, and we went through the photographs together and through all the materials, and it was kind of a natural extension of the work that we were doing. It was a very sensible thing, and everything I have will ultimately go into public hands. I don't believe that... People always say to me, you know, why don't you sell this on eBay or something? And it would be great because I could pay my mortgage then, but I'm very much a believer that these things should be available to the public. And I'm working on creating a kind of global virtual exhibition of his things so that anyone around the world can access these materials ultimately. So
then, you know, if it's going to the public, I assume it'll be USC or some museum that will ultimately, God willing, have the actual tangible things.
Yes, it'll be. I would like all of the tangible things to be in one place, if possible. I think that's better than having them spread out. And I've just kind of watching and looking at different institutions. It's you have to watch to see how they treat materials, and do they sell materials when they run out of money, and do they display things, and do they treat them properly and proper humidity and light and things like that. So,
hey, I've got a couple of shelves in my garage.
It's fun to think of that. I need a few more hours in the day, because with the show and the book and the archives, and then also the name, voice, and likeness, a lot of that involves just infringement. A lot of people basically appropriating his image without permission, and so that's a kind of police work that I'm not crazy about. I don't enjoy doing. It's not creative.
I assume you have a lawyer that you're always like, please deal with this. Please send a cease and desist.
The trust has a great lawyer for that. But then you have to be very careful, because you have to be careful what you go after and what kind of resources you want to put in that kind of thing. I found it so discouraging. Sometimes I would get up in the morning and I would go on eBay, and you'd spend the morning just knocking stuff off of eBay of people creating stuff that they're not entitled to create and selling stuff. And that's part of the reason I think that I was happy to create these shows about Gene's legacy, because I find that much more rewarding to actually get out and meet with people and present Gene as he wished to be represented to the world, and that puts a different spin on it, and is much more positive. I think it's better for the heart and soul. But I keep the other work going. But Gene was so articulate and so specific about how he wanted to be remembered, and it surprises people a bit, because he didn't really want to be remembered in front of the camera as a performer. He wanted to be remembered for being behind the camera as a director and choreographer, and so I've kind of reinstituted that, so that in people's memories that's how he'll be remembered.
And speaking of things that are rememberable, I don't even know if that's a word, but do you have one or two favorite keepsakes or things or items of Kelly, or that Kelly might have given to you, that are your most precious to you?
Well, there are some things in that people will see in the show, and I won't give those away there, but there are some things that there's a kind of reveal. I have some things that are very tender for me, that are, Gene was a true romantic, and I get into that quite a bit in the show, because he just looked at the world through the eyes of a romantic person, and I think that he would give me his gifts, often very unique, kind of very charming things that would be kind of quirky. But another thing that he would usually give me for my birthday and for holidays, he would give me a Limoges box or a Battersea box. They're little enamel boxes or little porcelain pieces. And in them, he would take a red Sharpie, and he would draw a heart on the inside, and sometimes write notes to me on the inside. And so those are really, really precious to have, this little display of those are right here on the desk next to me. And
That is.
Of his things,
yeah.
Well, his Converse tennis shoes, he was so cool and hip and ahead of his time. He wore the Chuck Taylors, and that's when I have pictures of us going, when we go out to dinner or something, he had on his Chuck Taylors.
Now, can I ask, it's been, as we say, it's almost two decades now since Gene Kelly passed away. You're still a young, beautiful, vibrant woman, etc. I mean, you've given your life to the legacy of this other person. Has that affected, I mean, have you dated? Are you going to remarry? And what is it like really spending 24/7 living through the life of someone else? Do you feel like you've given something up?
Well, that's about 12 questions.
I know. It's a Talmudic question.
I'll pick a couple of those. Well, one of them... gotta be really honest. It's a pretty hard act to follow. I mean, you you find a Gene Kelly. They just don't make him like that anymore. I mean, he wasn't a triple threat. He was like a quadruple, quintuple threat. And I don't say no. People always ask me, have you remarried and are you going to remarry? And I don't have any blanket thing about that. I don't say no to it. And I'm so, I don't, it's not a creepy thing of me being wedded to this past. I love what I do. I love my life with this. And I think one of the things that's so fun and exciting about it is that it enables me to meet so many new people and also to touch so many young people. I think that's one of the greatest things about it, is that it isn't really about Gene Kelly dead and 102. It's about Gene Kelly cool and relevant and still inspiring young people. And so I meet these dancers, and, you know, speaking of hip hop and body poppers, and these terrific performers, and you know, like a Robbie Fairchild of the New York City Ballet. I get a Google alert, and he's in an interview saying that his inspiration was Gene Kelly. And I'll find Fabrice Carmels, who dances with Joffrey Ballet, will say, "Oh my God, he was my hero." And Roberto Bollet, the great classical dancer, and I get to spend time with the San Francisco Ballet and all of the dancers touched by Gene. And I'm going to be, it's the American Tap Dance Foundation that is presenting my show in New York on July 9th. And you've got a whole plethora of young dancers. And then you've got also people like Ben Vereen, who were inspired by Gene. And so I think what's great about it is that it isn't, it's 24/7 Gene, but it's also 24/7 the world. I get to engage with the world, and I think that's a nice gift from Gene for this work that I do. I mean, it's something that just extends. It just never really stops. And the show is going to Zurich next January. It's going to Canada. It just rolls out. It's like I always say, if you build it, I will come. And
well, we only wish they would build it in northern Colorado here. We would love to have you, if they could get you at the UCCC or here at UNC.
Well, I think you and I, Rabbi, ought to get together and make that happen, because I think that would be brilliant. And as you know, I grew up there in Fort Collins, Colorado, and still have my roots there. And so I think it's a perfect connection. And I always tell people to go on GeneKelly.com and subscribe, because that way they'll get notices where the shows are, and they'll know if it's coming to their area. And then also to contact me and let me know. I heard from some wonderful dancers in Reno, Nevada last week, begging for the show in Reno. And I said, okay, where's the theater, and do you know anybody? And they're helping to put all this together. So again, that's kind of what's wonderful about this, is that it has a very organic feeling to it. It's a very grassroots thing, that people who love him and love what he represents kind of come together with me to make this happen. It's a word of mouth thing. I don't really advertise. I just, people tell other people, and it's kind of fun how it spreads.
Well, it's been fun and a delight talking with Patricia Ward Kelly here in the neighborhood. Everybody, please go to the Peter J. Sharp Theater. That's up on 95th Street and Broadway on Wednesday, July 9th for Gene Kelly, The Legacy. Last question for Ms. Kelly. Let me ask you, do you do Q&A after your presentation? I mean, I know you talked to the audience afterwards. So what is like one or two of the weirdest questions people have asked you over the years when you've been doing this presentation?
Well, and I do not do, that's one of the things that I do not do. I do a Q&A often when I introduce a movie or something, but I don't do a Q&A as part of the show, a formal part.
Okay.
But as you're right, I do speak with people, and I hope all of your listeners will come up and say hello and tell me that that's how they got to the show. What would be the oddest thing? That's a good question. I'll have to kind of think about it. I'm trying to think. I do speak in a lot of schools, and the kids will ask very insightful questions, and they will ask. They often want to know if he was romantic. I mean, that's one of the things that surprises me, because to me, so obviously that. They often want to know how he died. People will ask that, which I think is an important part of the story and is a major part of the book that I'm writing, because that was something that we shared so obviously intimately. And
so you were there for the last, you were there at the moment, were you?
Yes, I was very, very fortunate to be there, and it was, he wanted very much to die at home and to die without pain, and interestingly, those were two very difficult things to accomplish with a man of such great celebrity, but we did accomplish that, and it was really a beautiful death. So I think that we accomplished that against kind of great odds. So, but I'll have to think. That's a good. I should jot down some of the things. So much happens that there's so many people kind of coming up, and I need to jot down more of the questions. That you're provoking me to do that. I'll do that next time. And
well, then here's the a fair corollary question. Have people come up to you and said, "Oh, I remember him when," and I'm giving you an anecdote that you didn't know about.
Often, and particularly, I just did the show in his hometown of Pittsburgh, and a lot of people came out of the woodwork there, and he had taught dance in his own, well, at the Beth Shalom Shul,
right.
And then he also taught dance at his own Gene Kelly Studio of the Dance in Pittsburgh and Johnstown, and so a lot of people came out, and one woman actually brought photographs of herself, and it was kind of a touching moment, because she had been severely burned as a child. And for the performances, she didn't know how she could wear a costume, but Gene had taught her how to dance, and it was his mother who kind of ran the school and helped with the costumes and things, and had helped devise a costumes for the girl that would conceal some of the damage done by the burn. And so she gave those to me after the show, and I was just really moved by that. And other people brought programs from different performances that he did for the kids and things different. He did the Kermesses for the kids, and so they would bring those. And so people bring objects and things to share. A lot of times it will be a grandparent or a parent or... because they're not too many of the actual kids who are still alive, but something's touching. I had a woman who, in Denver, when I did the show in Denver, she had grown up in Poland, and she came up, and she was just weeping, and she just said, she was, "I'm so sorry, I'm sorry." She said, "But we couldn't see movies. Everything was so clamped down, but we could see one, there would be one movie a year, and it was Gene Kelly," and she said, "He was my joy, the only joy," you know, and so that was a pretty powerful moment. So it's, every time something, it seems like every time something different happens, and somebody comes up, and it's really, people talk about it. I mean, it's gotten very nice reviews in the Hollywood Reporter and things like that. But and I get very nice email from people. People will just write people I don't know and send notes about how they've lost a husband and why it touched them and things. But I have to say, it's a very reciprocal thing. I mean, what I get out of it each night is perhaps even more than the audience gets out of it. It's that powerful for me.
Well, it has been a powerful joy that we have gotten so much out of here in the neighborhood, talking to Patricia Ward Kelly. Go see her on July 9th at Symphony Space for Gene Kelly, The Legacy. Well, I only hope, my big wish for you is, now that this interview is over, chain yourself to the writing desk, get yourself, you know, those red pens that you need for editing, and work, work, work on that book. Let's have it sometime this century, please.
Well, you sound like my mother and father, but I've got to tell you that given what I've done in this last week, I don't think that is... I think that's actually going to happen now. I think you'll be seeing that book rolling out in the not-too-distant future. So I'll look forward. Maybe I can come back on the show when that happens.
It would be our honor, and especially, again, if you find the place in Colorado that we can work on to do the show here, certainly we would love to have you back in the neighborhood singing In and Out of the Rain. Patricia Ward Kelly, shalom to you.
Shalom to you, and thank you. It's been a real delight to speak with you.
Likewise. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.